Good morning. Welcome to Current State. I'm your host, Mickey Herton, filling in for Mark Bayshore, who's on a very well-deserved vacation. Hey, I'm the associate publisher of Lansing City Pulse, and I also write for Greater Lansing Business Monthly magazine. But today, I'm your radio host. Hey, what a beautiful weekend with so much going on. I hope you made it out to the Blues Fest. Great time, great music, great crowd. And then there was the Capital City River Run also yesterday. Thousands of people there. So congratulations to everyone who participated in those races. Way to go. Hey, this morning we want to talk about theater. To me, it's one of the heralds of spring, of fall. We have MSU football, kids go back to school, and you know the new theater season starts up. This morning we have with us Tony Casale, who's artistic director of Williamston Theater.
Hi there.
Morning. And Emily Sutton Smith, actress, singer, director, producer, just about a development director, and just about everything.
Hello.
And it's yes. Well, thank you for being here. It's a wonderful time. I mean, the theater is. Well, I guess it's award-winning theater, certainly.
Sure is.
You won in 2014. You were recognized as a National Theater Company grant. Mm-hmm. Got that. That was good.
From the American Theater Wing.
What does that symbolize? What does that mean?
It's a really great recognition by our peers that we're doing something right. Mm-hmm. The American Theater Wing is one of the oldest theater organizations in the country. It's based in New York City. They do, little things like the Obie Awards and the Tony Awards and stuff like that. So they sort of know what they're talking about. And they do have these programs. They have, you know, the regional Tony Award for larger theaters that have been around for, you know, decades and decades and have many, many arms of programming. But then they have the programs that recognize smaller theaters like us. Theaters between the ages of 5 and 15 that are under a certain amount of annual budgets. And they say, let's see what you're doing. Show us what you got. And so you apply. And if they recognize you, it's kind of a thumbs up. It's a stamp of approval from a national organization of great reputation to say, you guys are on the right track.
Well, it seems that they like what they see there. And clearly, you have a big impact. Hey, Tony, you do a bunch of directing. You'll be directing a number of the shows this year, correct?
I'm doing two of them, yeah.
Yep. Tell us about the season. What are you looking for?
Sure. Well, the season this year, you know, we always try and find a sort of a mix of things. We have a tendency to focus on shows that are funny, shows that are warm, shows mm-hmm. that, you know, the catchphrase I think we use at the office all the time is we would love for people to come and laugh and cry and then want to call the people you love when you're done. You know, and we do a lot of shows that way, but we also mix it up a little bit. We'll throw in, like this season, we're doing 1984, George Orwell, because that's got some relevance to the world we're living in, you know. And so, yeah, the season coming up is a mix of things. We're starting with a world premiere by a Michigan playwright, Joseph Zettelmeyer, called Pulp, which is going to be a lot of fun.
Right. I wonder if people recognize how intimate your theater is. I mean, I say intimate, and I think of small is one way. But, I mean, what, 3 or 4 rows deep? I mean, you're right there on top of the action.
Yeah.
Yep, 100 seats.
It was on purpose. You know, when we're looking for a space, we didn't want to go too big. That intimacy is something we really like. You know, you get to be that close to the audience. The audience gets to be right there breathing with the actors. It's a lot of fun.
Tell us about the first show. Is this Pulp?
Pulp by Joseph Zettelmeyer. Pulp, we're really excited. As Emily was talking about, like the American Theater Wing, one of the other organizations that we're thrilled to be recognized by this season is the National New Play Network, which is the organization all over the country that supports new plays and the theaters that do them. And so this production of Joe's play, Pulp, is a rolling world premiere. So there are 3 companies doing it at more or less the same time as a world premiere. And it's really fun. It's sort of a film noir, murder mystery, science fiction, action adventure comedy.
Set in L.A. in the 1930s,
yeah.
So very evocative time
Could
period.
You squeeze in anything else into that theme?
It's fun, and that I think that was his goal with it. There are all these smashing genres being crushed together in the show, so it's a ton of fun.
Emily, you've worked closely with MSU
mm-hmm.
on these productions. Can you talk about that a little bit?
We have a partnership with the MSU Department of Theater, which is a wonderful partnership for both entities. we have on this show, Mark Colson is one of their faculty members, is in the show. We have a graduate design student who's doing the costume design.
Former grad student doing the set design.
We've got another faculty design person doing the lighting design. So there's great talent that we can tap into there, but then we also have some undergrads that work across the board on the whole season. We'll have undergrads backstage. And for those students, it's their first exposure, for a lot of them, to a professional atmosphere, to the way things are done. And it also allows them to join the Equity Membership Candidacy Program, which is the first step to becoming a union member.
Do they get equity credit for any of this?
They do. They get their points. You have to earn a certain number of points to be able to be allowed in the union.
Right.
And so for a young person, it can take you quite a long time to earn those points. I think you have something like 5 years to do it.
Yeah.
So we've heard from other students who have gone out into the world, it also gets you into auditions. Being an equity member candidate, if you're not a member yet, it can get you in the door just to audition, to keep getting work. So it's a great first step on their professional careers.
And, you know, when Emily and I went to New York to accept the American Theater Wing Award a couple years ago, one of the most fun things we've ever, I think, been able to do is they let us invite a whole bunch of people to the ceremony and to the big giant party afterwards. And a whole bunch of the people that we had to invite were former MSU students who had worked at the theater and gotten their professional career started that way and were now in New York working. And it was so great to surround ourselves with those people at that event. It was really cool.
Well, it seems so gratifying that you've sort of nurtured them. You've been one of the cradles for their development.
Yeah. It's a wonderful opportunity. That relationship that Williamston Theater has with the MSU Department of Theater is pretty great.
I mean, I think I've always found it interesting that it's an equity theater. And not to denigrate other theater companies in the area, but I mean, this gives it a professional sheen that I think you certainly see in the performances. Do you have a regular ensemble cast?
There are wonderful artists in Michigan, and we tap into the artists who are here, who are Michigan, centered artists, both on stage and backstage. So while we don't have a set company, you might see the same people, season to season. I'm on stage often. I was on stage in two shows last year. My husband, John Leppard, who's our executive director, also one of the founders of the theater, he's in Pulp. He's also going to be in 1984. So you'll see him. But, you'll see some of the professors from MSU who've worked with us before and some familiar faces who work again and again, partially because we like working with them. They're good people. They're good artists. We know that they bring a lot to the table. But also there's a lot of talent here in Michigan.
Yeah, and that's one of the fun challenges. A big part of my job is picking the season every year and working through how do we want to present ourselves? What do we want to say over the course of a season? But part of that is looking at the sort of loose company of people that we know we like working with out of Michigan's professional acting community and out of Michigan's non-union acting community, because there's a strong one of those too. And we get to pick from both. And picking the season, we're trying to find projects to use those people we like. So a lot of times we'll shape it towards who we know we can work with too.
And last season, I think we created something like 78 jobs.
Oh, really?
For artists in Michigan. And that's something that's part of our mission. We're creating their artistic home and giving them artistic voice and also providing them work, meaning they stay here. They don't go to New York or Chicago.
Well, you talk about the economics of it. I mean, and that's really what jobs are about. But you've had a pretty significant influence on Williamston.
It's a different looking town than it was 10 years ago when we started.
Yeah.
There are a lot of restaurants now. There was one restaurant when we started, and there are something like six fairly high-end, really nice restaurants in town. And that's not all us, but we're certainly an anchoring part of the downtown area. Anytime you have a cultural entity, it's going to bring people in. And 80% of the people that come to see shows at the theater don't live in Williamston. So
right.
That's a lot of people over the course of a year if we're bringing in 10,000-11,000 people over the course of one season. So, and people are starting to get to know Williamston as a really nice little town to come and get really good food. And it's walkable and the parking is easy and there's a beautiful park and there's all these events that happen in town. So the people who live in Williamston really know all of the assets that it has. But now our patrons are beginning to understand what there is there as well. And it is developing this identity, you know?
Yeah, it is. It's really exciting for us. I mean, like you said, 10 years ago when we were getting started, you could roll into town on a Saturday afternoon and there would be not a lot going on. It was quiet. And now, Saturday afternoon, you can see the show gets out and the restaurants and the ice cream shop and the art studio across the street, those fill up. And that's a lot of fun.
I just want to remind you that we're speaking with Tony Caselli, who's the artistic director at Williamston Theater, and Emily Sutton-Smith, an actress and development director there. You've talked about 10 years, which I'm sure has gone more quickly than you could believe.
In a blink.
Yes.
but how's the theater company doing? I mean, you start from nothing, and now you've won some awards. I mean, what's the trajectory?
Hopefully it's always growth. You know, it's funny, we started this thing in 2006 and we said, well, the economy doesn't look so good right now, but surely it will get better. Haha. And then, you know, so we've learned stuff. And what's been really great is that, you know, every season we look back and we say, what do we do right? What do we do wrong? Where do we need to economize? How do we develop, you know, the ability to grow? And we've watched some of our colleagues over the years, and you see some plans that don't work as well as you think they're going to work. It's also a very different world than it was.
Yes.
In the 90s and the 80s as regional theaters were growing and things like that. So we're always looking to be smart and manage well. And right now we are doing fine, and we are trying to make sure that we plan any growth that we do very carefully. And there's always need. We always have to raise money, and we always have to write grants, and we always have to appeal to people for support. But we have this amazing audience that loves us.
Yeah, and having that support of the main sort of patron base that we have, plus, as Emily said, we're getting started to get more regional and national attention, just in the sense of, oh, look, those guys have done that for 10 years now. That's really gratifying and exciting. And we've been able to hit a handful of goals that sort of amaze me sometimes that, you know, we just hit our 10-year anniversary. We just published our anthology of the all of the brand new world premiere plays that we've done over the first decade, and that's out there for people to be able to buy now. We hit a cool statistic that really excited me this year. At the end of season 10, we looked back, and over the course of 10 years, four of those seasons, almost half of them, the best-selling show was a world premiere by a Michigan playwright. And for me, as the artistic director, that's a pretty exciting stat, because you hear so often, oh, you got to program what people know, you know.
You got to do the old chestnuts.
And we have a tendency to try and avoid the old chestnuts or bring them in for special occasions. And so that's a pretty great stat, that we're putting out new work by people who are born and raised and live and work here in the Midwest. And that, for me, is important.
You're creating new chestnuts.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We hope so.
Someone's got to do that. Well, this coming year, do you have a musical? We do. Talk about that.
Oh, the season wraps up next summer with a ridiculous musical called Murder for Two, which is two performers. One of them, the story goes around solving a murder, as you would expect, and one of them plays the young, fresh-faced, up-and-coming wannabe detective, and the other performer plays all 13 suspects. And the two performers sing the whole show and play their own piano the whole play. It's a ridiculous amount of fun. I can't wait.
Who are you directing that? No, I guess it's Rob. Rob is doing that.
Yeah, I'm very excited. Rob Rosnowski, another one of our MSU connections, is going to direct that. And yeah, that's a show that is just recently taken off around the nation, and we get to do it here. It's going to be great.
Do you have most sellouts? I mean, the times I've been there, it's always been pretty packed. I mean, what's your,
There tends to be, we're noticing that our patrons are a little on the pokey side. Everybody puts it off to the very end to come see. So actually what happens is that we end up with, you know, smaller houses at the beginning of a run, and then people can't get in at the end. So we're always saying, come early, and then tell your friends about it, because it's really great advertising for us when someone comes to see a show and says, it's still running for 4 weeks, go see it. But yeah, we tend to, they get full at the end of the run.
Yeah.
The I think one of the issues you have to face is theater, though, is the age of your audiences, isn't it? I mean, it's interesting. You work with MSU, So you have a naturally young connection. But I don't think I misspeak when I say that generally speaking, you go there and it's an older audience. How do you address that? I mean, how do you interest my kids, for example, in regional theater?
I think one of the things you hit on is right. The connection with MSU does bring in a chunk of a younger audience, which is really nice. But there is this gap of age where, you know, I think you look at the life cycle of people and go, oh, this is the part where everybody generally starts to have kids and get busy and have no extra income. And then once the kids are away in college and they get a little more time, then they come back to the theater. And so we sort of see that happening a good bit.
I didn't realize how true that was until John and I had a son 5 years ago. And I went, oh.
This is why they're not here.
Yeah, it's really hard to find a babysitter.
Yeah, and you just program, you know, we all are always looking at the mix of shows and hoping to draw in people who are just interested in good stories.
Are the types of shows, though, you decide not to do because they simply don't fit the Williamston Theater, you know,
sure.
Abilities?
Yeah, absolutely. Every now and then I'll look at a show and go, this would be great, except it needs 18 actors. And as you said, our stage is 15 by 15. So there's nowhere for me to put them. You know, those kind of things will happen. And occasionally there are shows that I love or we as a staff look at and love, but we know there's no way we're going to sell 6 weeks of it. And so then we'll find another outlet for that. We do weekends series of staged readings and things like that, our
Dark Nights and Billtown series,
which if there's a show like that that we really love and think is a good thing the audience might want to see, like our patrons might be interested in this, we'll do a weekend reading of it instead of a full production.
I mean, are there other outreach efforts that you use to sort of stir up the interest in the theater?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we've just recently added is we are a Blue Star Theater, recognized by the Theater Communication Group as a Blue Star Theater, meaning that we offer discounts and special opportunities to members of the military and their families. So we have a standard $2 discount for all members of the military, but then also we do a matinee, a military matinee that's a pay what you can. So we try and reach out to that demographic as well. And we have, you know, other programming, the Dark Nights in Billtown. We do pay what you can performances. Our actually Thursday night is pay what you can. So we're trying to give people access.
It says it reminds me of that Little Rascals show, pay as you exit.
Yeah.
Yep.
But I mean, I guess that works and it does. I think would entice some people who might not normally go.
Yeah.
And come
and we do talkbacks with our preview performances. We do a Conversation Sunday where we bring in panelists to talk about the issues that are being addressed in the show, or they get to meet the actors or they get to meet the playwright. And so I think engaging an audience with some of the backstage stuff is helpful, and it gives people, everybody wants to know more.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I've found to be fascinating is over the course of the 10 years, we do a preview process for every production. So the first five shows, we're not officially open. We're technically still in rehearsals. And for the first four performances of that, we do talkbacks with the audience. And we've built up a crowd of people who will come specifically to one of the first four shows so they can see it and participate in that feedback process. And then a month later, come back and see it again and go, oh, look what you changed, you know, and developing that group of people has been a lot of fun.
Well, this has been terrific. I'm excited about the upcoming season, as I'm sure you are. We've been talking with Tony Caselli, Artistic Director at Williamston Theater, and Emily Sutton-Smith, Actress Development Director and a founder of this theater company. I want to thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Have a great season. I'll be there. I'll see some of your shows.
Great.
And listeners, you know where to get your tickets, Williamston Theater. Hey, despite entering Saturday night's primetime game against Notre Dame as underdogs, the Spartans moved to 2-0 this year. The performance was so convincing they moved up in a bunch of the, well, in the AP football poll for the week, stayed about the same in the USA Today poll. We'll be chatting with current sports host Al Martin about what went right with the green and white this past weekend, as well as what went wrong for the Detroit Lions in that depressing home opener loss yesterday against the Tennessee Titans. That's later this hour on Current State. The Detroit narrative of strength and resilience is well known, as is its reputation for celebrating culture, creativity, and art. This picture of Detroit is embodying one of the city's gems, Dabble Embad, African Bead Museum, which has been in operation in West Detroit for more than 16 years. Current State's Katie Cook went to Detroit to see the museum, and she joins me now. Hey, Katie.
Hi, Mickey.
Tell us about the founder of this bead museum.
Well, his name is Oliemi Dabbles, and he's an artist and a visual storyteller. And this museum he started has become a destination for people from all over the world. I actually found out about it from my friend who lives in Texas, and she found out about it from someone who makes jewelry down there. So it just shows you how far-reaching it is, and it's not just a locally celebrated place. So it sounded so interesting to me, I had to check it out. And after my trip there, I understand why it attracts so many visitors.
If you're driving through the west side of Detroit, there's one corner that will definitely catch your eye, the corner of Grand River and West Grand Boulevard. You'll see a large building that's covered in brightly colored murals and mosaic art. This is the Embad African Bead Museum. It was founded by a man named Oliemi Dabbles, and it all started with a collection.
In 1998, I began to collect African beads. And about that same time, there were three or four good books came out on dealing with the bees out of Africa. To my surprise, the bees were not used for adornment. They were used to communicate Pacific information about Pacific people or events, or initiation, rites of passage, all those things that the people deemed important could be communicated in how they wore the beads. And that's why I decided I wanted to tell the story of how those beads were used and that they were so intertwined within the community. If you removed the beads, you destroyed that particular culture.
Why did you want to have the museum here? Why did you want to tell these stories in this particular neighborhood in Detroit?
Well, that was primarily by chance. We were looking for any place to locate, but this place presented itself mainly because the owner of the property, a lady named Artie Riddick, donated the two buildings to me to build a museum. And it really didn't matter wherever we built it in the city, that would become the place where it would grow and become a part of the community. But it was important that it's in the community. It's very difficult to build something for the community in the downtown area. It's an inconvenience to come there. It costs money to come into the downtown area, but in the community, there's no parking fees, there's no hassle. There were all kinds of perks that we were not aware of at the time. Being in the community, you automatically get a lot of support because you are in the community. We're accessible to local people, and then people literally come here from all over the world to see the unique space that we have developed here, with the anchor being the bees.
I'm wondering if you have a particular type of bead or story associated with any bead that's special to you that you could tell me about?
Well, I can give you some general information about the bees that we're surrounded by. Most of these bees are averaging 300 to 400 years old, and they had special uses in the community, which could change 100 miles down the road. The bees that I like the best are the ones that were made in Ghana, because the Ghanaian people actually made their own beads, and those bees are literally known all over the world. Because of the technique and how they made those bees. We have bees, the red and dot bees up there, those bees are called the Eva Eye bees. They were used to protect a person's word. The further you go back in the past, the most important thing you had was your word. We have bees that were only worn by certain members of the community. The carnelian bees were only worn by people in high rank within the Nigerian and Yoruba community. Ethiopian amber from Ethiopia. So all the beads in here, there is no bead here that has a lesser meaning or value to the people. It's just that some have been deemed more important by Western collectors, but they all have a reason for being in a particular culture in Africa.
You mentioned amber. What are some of the other materials that these beads are made of?
Glass, bronze, silver, stone like bauxite, carnelian, horn, granite stone, various animals, bone, camel. Some of the beads are made, are recycled out of glass that has been recycled that was used for commercial reasons. All the various materials on the planet at one point in time were used to make beads.
What can you tell me about the beads you're wearing right now?
The beads I have on now are 2,000 years old. They are from Mauritania, and they are called Roman eye beads, which has nothing to do with Rome. I don't know where the name came from, but they are 2,000 years old and some of the most sought-after beads on the planet. So I wear them around here sometime.
They're beautiful.
Thank
so many
you.
Different colors.
Yes.
Are they made of clay or?
It's glass. Glass has been made for at least 5,000 years. And the color, they knew how to take various materials to add color to glass, which is melted sand.
I'm speaking with Oliemi Dabbles. He's the founder of the Dabbles Bead Museum here in Detroit. You're in the process of going through some expansion, is that right?
Yes, we received a nice grant, a matching grant for $100,000. We're in the process of raising those funds, and it's one of those programs because of the people who come here are literally from various parts of the planet. It means our fundraiser would not be a local fundraiser, it would be an international fundraiser to raise that $100,000 to put the roof on the building. Then we will be able to display and exhibit the museum's collection. At this time, the gallery has museum quality beads in it, but these beads are for sale to underwrite the cost of operation.
The roof he's referring to is on the same building I described earlier, the one you can see on the corner. The roof caved in about 8 years ago, destroying thousands of Dabbles paintings. And they haven't been able to use the inside of the building since. The bead gallery is currently housed in a very tiny building behind this building. Dabbles says this new roof will create new opportunities.
We will be able to utilize our space year-round. Now we're just a seasonal operation here. This is the largest space we have, and most of our activities occur outside. But in the winter, when we put the roof on the building, we will be able to have workshops. Our community will be able to use our space to do whatever they want to do. And that was one of the side effects of being here, is the people from the community get to use this space at no cost to them to do their programming. So we are serving a much needed venue space in the community. We don't charge people to use our space.
Aside from serving as a bead gallery, museum, and community space, Dabbles African Bead Museum is also a work of art. Dabbles explains that that wasn't always part of the plan.
Well, it was part of the growth process. When we first moved here in 1999, the economy had collapsed in the African community. So there was no way for us to move forward with the bead museum. But this space was here. There was debris, rubbish all over the place. So we decided to just beautify the area, to clean the area up. And the first thing we did was to paint murals on the building, and the community welcomed that with open arms. So we decided that we would clean the lot in back of the museum. And as we were doing that, the Greening of Detroit went to city council saying that if there was a lot, a person could grow a garden. And in that garden, if there was space, the artist could put art up. So under that umbrella, we began to build those installations out there. And the installations kind of like catapulted us onto the world stage. And 16 years later, we're in a better position to open the Beat Museum now because we have visitors. There were two other museums that had opened in this country, and they both failed after about 5 years of operating because they couldn't create an interest in beads. It wasn't the time, it wasn't right. So at this point in time, there's an interest in beads all over the world by all kinds of people. So the museum has a much better chance of operating as a bead museum. But our installations stand up on themselves because of the theme behind them.
That theme is the relationship between Africans and Europeans, and it's expressed with a variety of different materials in 18 different installations that make up the sculpture garden.
This is an installation that took over 16 years to make. It's titled Iron Teaching Rocks How to Rust. It's a metaphor that deals with the relationship of Africans and Europeans over the last 500 years. And that's what this whole installation is detailing in these installations, certain aspects of that experience of Africans and Europeans.
One of the installations is a washing machine with various materials inside.
The washing machine is a symbol for cleaning things. There's iron, rocks, and wood in the washing machine, which says no matter who you are, you cannot wash away what you are. You see qualities in others, respect those qualities, but never try to be no more than yourself, because you are the it. It's not someone else.
Looking across the sculpture garden, you can see chunks of concrete scattered among the art installations, and you can't really tell if it's random or intentional. It turns out there's a story behind this.
In 1996 or 97, the city of Detroit redid Grand River. Now, in those days, they wasn't recycling the road as they went along, so they were taking the old concrete somewhere else and grinding it up. So this was the area that they dumped the concrete they didn't use. So when we came here, we had all these slabs of concrete and stuff. And the city said, you know, you need to talk to the people who left it. So I knew that was going to be a runaround. So I said, now what would nature do? Nature would just cover this stuff up and grass grow over it. So this is not landscape. This is the result of all this concrete slabs and things. You can't dig three feet anywhere out here without running into concrete. And you can see pieces of the concrete and debris kind of coming through. But it made for a good landscape, because we got these Roman hills and valleys out here now. It makes it a natural place for an exhibit to exist.
The last part of this outdoor exhibit is really impressive. There's an African language wall, which is a long wall with phrases of 28 different African languages painted on it. And then there's the Nkisi House. This is a huge house covered completely in painted murals and fragments of iron, rocks, wood, and mirrors.
One day I was out here, and the inspectors were out here, and I asked them, what are you going to do with this property? They said, well, it's a process of 3 years. We're going to tear it down. So I said, okay, can I put some art on it? They said, do what you want with it. It's not our property.
So Dabbles and his artists turned it into a work of art and called it the Nkisi House. That's N-K-I-S-I. Nkisi originated in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. They are spirits or objects that spirits inhabit. Dabbles describes the Nkisi as a source of power and protection, which is what he says he wanted for the house.
So I asked this house to do three things when I built it, that the graffiti artists wouldn't tag it, the vandals wouldn't vandalize it, and the city wouldn't see it. Because at that time, we were operating outside of the law of the city. But since then, they have allowed us to operate here.
Visiting Dabbles African Bead Museum is not only a feast for the eyes, it's an enlightening experience. Through the beads and murals and sculptures, you're connected to the powerful history of African culture.
That's what we're doing here, is educating in a very artistic way, where we're not making people defensive, blaming, inflaming. We're just trying to get the point of the story across as to, because history should be used as a vehicle to educate about things that can change the present, not excite people from the past.
For Current State, I'm Katie Cook.
Welcome back to Current State on WKAR 90.5 FM. I'm your host, Mickey Hurton, filling in for Mark Bayshore. Just a reminder, our next Pop-Up Stories live storytelling event is Thursday, September 29th at Reach Studio Arts Center at 6 p.m. Hey, we still have room for storytellers. The theme is turning over a new leaf. So if you have a five-minute story on that theme, email us at currentstate@wkar.org. What looked to be a complete runaway game throughout much of the contest quickly turned into a dogfight in South Bend between the Michigan State Spartans and Notre Dame. They saw a 29-point lead cut to just 8 with about 6 minutes left to play, but would hold on for a big road win. Gutsy effort for why the Spartans are now ranked this week as the number 8 team in the college football poll by both the Associated Press and the Amway Coaches Poll. We now invite our own very own Al Martin, host of WKAR's Current Sports, to talk Michigan State football, as well as touch on the Detroit Lions failing in their depressing home opener loss to the Tennessee Titans. And we're also joined by Current State's Scott Pohl.
Morning.
Welcome, gentlemen.
Good Hi. Morning, Mickey. How you doing?
Good, good. So big weekend for the Spartans.
Huge weekend. I mean, I think that when you evaluate this game, and you just mentioned Mickey Howe, I mean, they saw a 29-point lead dwindle to just 8. I mean, there were many Spartan fans watching that game in that fourth quarter really on the edge of their seats and feeling a bit unnerving, to say the least. But nonetheless, as Mark D'Antonio loves to say, he loves to say that old line from George Perlis, hey, they all count one, right? And they all count one. A win is a win.
I kept turning away. I've seen this before. I can't watch it, but they did it. And but what happened? I mean, what do you guys figure?
Well, you know, for Scott, before you go on your rant, I just to talk about the offensive line
of
for
course.
A minute, because when you evaluate that offensive line, that's what really stood out to me, in complete contrast to what happened in game one against Furman. I mean, especially in the third quarter, that's when MSU really exploded and really notched, went out to that 29-point lead. The offense scored 3 touchdowns. They had 260 yards on the ground, 164 in the third quarter alone. And then you evaluate time of possession. I mean, there is a 16-minute differential when evaluating the time that Notre Dame had the football on offense compared to Michigan State. And, you know, I actually clocked that final drive the first half.
Yeah.
Michigan State got the football to end the first half at 5:06. They gave it back to Notre Dame with under a minute left in that first half. Notre Dame, of course, that drive fizzled out and they go into halftime feeling pretty good. I mean, but that really stood out to me also. The wide receivers, I think that R.J. Shelton, when you evaluate that talented wide receiver core, R.J. Shelton, in my opinion, is the most consistent out of all of them. I thought R.J. was fantastic. Monty Medeiros is his name. You can also bring up Donnie Corley with the spectacular catch. 190 total yards from the receivers. So,
we've got a quarterback, too.
Yeah, and the thing,
I mean,
well,
you know, because this was a question coming into the season.
It certainly was, and I think that Tyler O'Connor, you still have some growing pains with him, I think. I mean, you saw him underthrow a few receivers. You saw him with the interception. You see some growing pains with him. But at the same time, I thought he did an overall good job of just managing the game. And he made some things happen with his feet. I mean, when Michigan State needs to make a big play or get a first down, I mean, you saw Tyler O'Connor get out of the pocket, take his time. And again, he's not going to burst out for a 10 or 20 yard gain. He's just going to be very efficient with his feet just to do enough to move the chains.
But he picked up first downs, and that's all he had when he had the opening.
Certainly.
I still wish sometime when Terry is in the game that they would let him throw the ball, because so far it is so obvious that it's going to be a running play. When they put Terry into the game, that it's just not. an efficient offense when he's in the game. They got to let him throw the ball sometime out of that formation.
So true. It becomes so predictable, right, Scott? I mean, when Damian Terry is in the football game, you know that it's going to be a run to either side. So, yeah, they become very one-dimensional when that happens. But I think, you know, Tyler is he's playing good right now, but not great. There's still a lot of room for improvement, Mickey.
Well, yeah, and it's still pretty early in the season.
It is.
So, but, you know, we've seen the good signs, and you could have been, you know, could have had that moment where you're going, where do we really go from here? What are we seeing next? What's coming up?
Well, Wisconsin is this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And
tough game.
When you evaluate Wisconsin, and I must say this, though, when, you know, a big reason why Michigan State was an underdog heading into this Notre Dame game, in my opinion, had to do because they were ranked higher than Notre Dame in both polls, excuse me. But when you look at, you know, this week, that week two bye, I mean, you expect a guy and a team in Michigan State with a new quarterback in Tyler O'Connor to come off a week two bye and have to go on the road to try and beat Notre Dame, a team that's already in a groove. They played all 3 weeks. They're feeling pretty good. DeShone Kizer looks like a playmaker, and you expect them to win. That's why Michigan State was an underdog in that game. For me, when you evaluate the schedule, this game against Notre Dame was the biggest question mark for me. And the reason why I, along with a lot of people out there, chose Michigan State as an underdog in that game. When you look at the rest of the schedule, there is not a game you can point at and say, I don't know about that one for the Spartans, in my opinion, when evaluating right. their chances to win.
Well, and I also thought Notre Dame had that first game loss. Mm-hmm. And so they got a chip on their shoulder.
Right.
And they say this is a must game if we want to do
Texas,
anything.
Yeah.
We've got to win this. So you say that's extra, and I think another reason that they were, you know, the favorite and playing at home, you know, is always a big deal
right.
for them.
Al, Mickey, the prevent defense and going in the shell as early as State did.
Yeah,
I understand the size of the lead and the temptation to do that on offense, run to take time off the clock. But the prevent defense, I'm from the school of thought that the prevent defense prevents victory. A lot of the time,
right.
and it almost did Saturday night.
Well, D'Antonio sort of said that.
Yeah.
I mean, he seemed
certainly.
To sort of fall on his sword on that. You know,
and Scott, you and I were talking. I mean, the thing is, I mean, it goes back to the old saying, you're playing not to lose instead of playing
right.
to win. You got to play to win at the same time. And it became very, talk about predictable, right? Michigan State, when it came to that offensive scheme, all Brian Kelly did was just load the box. He knew they were going to just run the football. That he loaded the box and forced Michigan State to punt it. And then it got scary because DeShone Kizer tried to really test that Michigan State leaky secondary. And it almost cost him the game, I must say.
A friend of mine yesterday, in talking about the game, said that Bo Schembechler used to say that he wouldn't go into the stall kind of a prevent defense and take time off the clock offense until he had a 5-touchdown lead.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that sounds crazy. Oh, why not do it when you've got a 4-touchdown lead? Well, Saturday night is why you don't do it with a 4-touchdown lead.
Totally agree. You got to play to win the game. And they got way too conservative on both sides of the ball. But and we've seen Michigan State do this in the past as well. I mean, when I saw it, and I'm sitting there saying to myself, okay, again, this could become very interesting. And I really thought that Notre Dame could have pulled out a comeback there.
Hey, we're speaking with Al Martin, the host of WKAR's Current Sports, and also with our own Current States, Scott Pohl. Well, so they, let's switch over to the Lions.
Yeah.
And get off the good news.
Do we have to, Mickey?
Really? Yeah, do we have to, Mickey? But go ahead.
Oh, it was so depressing, wasn't it? I mean, watching, they were up, they had it, about 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes left. The Titans get a touchdown. And I guess it was a minute and a half.
Yeah, it was a minute and a half. And I really thought that Matthew Stafford, who was getting a lot of flack on many sports talk shows from here to Pluto due to that late game interception, I thought Matthew Stafford had a pretty good game until that fourth quarter interception. He tried to squeeze a back foot throw in traffic to Eric Ebron. Really nothing there. Game over. But, you know, look at his stats. I mean, he was 22 of 40 for 260 yards. You know, he was really hurt by a lot of drops. Receivers dropped passes left mm-hmm. and right throughout that game. But, and then how about Matthew Stafford showing some toughness? We saw him get out there and block a few guys out there. We saw him lower,
yeah,
which
so
really could have been.
He blew a guy over.
Didn't he?
He
lowered,
he
had the
truck
stick on one guy, lowered the shoulder and put one defender on his back and, you know, got the first down. I'm sitting there saying, okay, that was a nice play, but that could have ended badly. Matthew Stafford is tough.
Yeah.
And I think this that interception is going to sort of overshadow what he was able to do throughout much of that game. Scott?
Okay, Al, 17 penalties for the Lions in that game. Now, listen,
Going for the NFL record, weren't they?
Well, it tied the team record. 17 tied the team record.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people will complain about the officiating, and I agree that it went overboard. But the Lions probably actually did commit 14 or 15 of those 17 penalties.
Certainly. I'd say about 80% of them. I would say about 80% of them. And then how about when, you know, they're in the red zone, and, you know, Matthew Stafford does a great job of finding Eric Ebron. They call it back for a – they said he pushed off.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't – again –
saw nothing.
I didn't see anything on that play.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, okay, it's like, all right, you know, see Matthew Stafford, stay composed, say, all right, let's play the next down. Then all of a sudden, they get two holding penalties and they have to kick a field goal. That is – you can't do that. Again,
right.
As you mentioned, Scott, 17 penalties for 138 yards. You cannot win or beat any team in the NFL, let alone the Tennessee Titans, if you play like that.
Compare and contrast. Mm-hmm. The New England Patriots, Tom Brady suspended. Garoppolo gets hurt.
Mm-hmm.
So they're playing someone named Jacoby Brissett at quarterback yesterday and still won.
Exactly.
The Lions – cannot win as consistently as they ought to when you look at a team like New England. Third-string quarterback doesn't matter. They go on to a victory. Why can't the Lions do that historically?
Right.
58 years it's been since they've won one playoff game in my lifetime.
My goodness.
This is so frustrating to be a Lions fan. Talk about the Patriots a little bit, though. How did they do that with a third-string quarterback?
Third-string quarterback, and, you know, when I saw Jimmy Garoppolo go down, I said to myself, oh, boy. I mean, now they have to rely on their third-string quarterback now. I mean, because, you know, Tom Brady's out with the whole Deflategate suspension. But this, the Patriots are a team that's created a culture, though, Scott. I mean, they've created a culture of winning. So when their backs are against the wall, this isn't a team that, again, I know how good Tom Brady is, one of the greatest quarterbacks, if not the greatest quarterback to ever play. But this is a team. Defensively and offensively, they have so many weapons, and they're so smart. They don't shoot themselves in the foot, and it led to yet another win on a Sunday for them. So moving forward, again, they'll get time back week four. So, you know.
Week five.
Okay, yes, because it's a four-week suspension, right? He'll come back on week five. I think if they just tread water like they've been. I mean, and they've been winning, you know, by quote-unquote treading water. When they get him back, they're going to be in great position. I think we'll see the Patriots back in the playoffs. And going back to the Lions, too, I thought that the run game for the Lions, which was so great against the Indianapolis Colts in week one. Again, the Lions, they ran for 137 yards, 106, of course, from their running backs. But they didn't get as much production from their backfield as they did last week. And, you know, look at guys like Ameer Abdullah, you know, Theo Riddick. I mean, they averaged just 3.4 yards. And that's put a lot of pressure on Matthew Stafford to try and go out there with a mindset, okay, I got to win this game by myself. And, you know, it led, unfortunately, to that late game interception.
We've got about 2 minutes to go. Baseball season's wrapping up. Thoughts on that?
Oh, boy, the Detroit Tigers. How about them, right?
Yeah. They finally beat Cleveland yesterday.
Yeah, they finally beat Cleveland. And, you know, it's 2 weeks left in the MLB season. And, again, this is when you got to start playing your best baseball. But it's been a catch-22 with this Detroit Tigers team this year. Either, you know, they'll come out and have great starting pitching, but no run support. Or the run support is there, and the starting pitching is nowhere to be found. So we haven't been able to really get an accurate read on this Detroit Tigers team this season because there has been nothing that has been even keel throughout the entire year. They're not going to win, of course, the division. I mean, the Cleveland Indians, I mean, they have that on lock in the AL Central. They're still in the mix for a wild card, and for Detroit Tigers fans out there, that's all they can hope for at this point.
Well, yeah, it's a crazy season. I mean, I'm a Yankee fan, so we were up there. You know, I know that you shouldn't say that.
But a year for the Yankees, right?
Well, it was until they started playing Boston this week, and now I'm going, that was just awful. But they're a rebuilding year, so we'll take it that way. Hey, I want to thank everyone. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here. We've been speaking with Al Martin, who's the host of WKAR's Current Sports, and with Current State's Scott Pohl, wrapping up the weekend football season, taking a little bit of look ahead. And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll speak with MSU senior who's just won a Student Academy Award. Elise Conklin will tell us about the making of her newly Oscar-winning documentary From Flint, Voices from a Poisoned City. That and more Tuesday on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Katie Cook has directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and Drew Hill. The Current State podcast is your informative, insightful, and indispensable connection with what's happening around mid-Michigan and beyond. From politics to education, environmental news to healthcare, science and tech to music and theater, stories from around the state and your hometown. That's the Current State podcast, anywhere, anytime, at iTunes, Switcher, or wherever you get your podcast. You can stay connected with Current State on Twitter at KAR Current State and on Facebook at Current States from WKAR. I'm Mickey Hurton, and you've been listening to Current State on WKAR. We'll see you tomorrow.